When people debate about climate change, which seems pretty much nonstop these days, it's generally about the science. Is it real? Is it true? Do all the scientists agree? These are the common questions. There are other questions to ask, a whole lot of them, as our guest points out this hour. Philip Kitcher joined fellow philosopher Evelyn Fox Keller in writing The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts. The six acts in the subtitle are six dialogues between average Joes, male Joe and female Joe, without the E. It's a fascinating expansion of the field of discussion on climate change. Philip Kitcher is a professor of philosophy at Columbia University with a focus on the philosophy of science and biology in particular. He also researches and teaches philosophical themes in music and literature. Evelyn Fox Keller also studies and teaches the philosophy of science and more. Her degrees are in physics. Philip Kitcher is our guest. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you borrowed the title from Shakespeare, I see, The Seasons Alter. Tell us what
Indeed.
That's from.
Indeed, from Midsummer Night's Dream. The world goes very peculiar at a point in Midsummer Night's Dream because Titania and Oberon, the king and queen of the fairies, have had a quarrel, and then that leads to this awful change in the climate, and they meet, and Titania, the queen, accuses Oberon of helping to cause this, and she says, you know, it's all our fault, really. That's what we've done it. And so we thought that would be quite an appropriate way to have a title for a book about climate change. The seasons are altering, and we're causing it.
Huh. All right. So this is not strictly a book of science, though. So what did you and Dr. Keller set out to do here?
Well, what we really wanted to do was get beyond what we think of as a highly polarized and unfortunate public conversation and get people talking to one another. So the aims of the book are really twofold. One is to give some models for how people might work through the issues with people they know and who disagree with them in a constructive and friendly and amicable fashion. And the other is actually to break up the entire climate change problem into its sort of major component parts. Because I think what happens is that people start off thinking that they're focusing on the science, and then very quickly they start getting into things about what are the consequences going to be for their lives, what really can be done, and all of that sort of makes a muddle of the questions. We try to separate them into our six dialogues so that they can be considered sequentially, and we hope that that will prove helpful.
Now, before the dialogues get going, there is a preface in which you cast into the future and imagine days far into the future, into the next century, where they're looking back at things like water wars. I mean, if we don't change our current approach, do you see it getting that grim?
It could be. Nobody, I think, can know just how apocalyptic the scenarios for the future are likely to be. So we start with something that's really on the apocalyptic end of things. We want to say to the reader, look, reader, you can't write this off as something that's beyond the limits of possibility. It's not beyond the limits of possibility, and we tell a story, which I think is a reasonably plausible story, of how almost all of our species could be wiped out. So you get droughts, people start quarreling with one another, they quarrel with one another on a grand scale, it escalates, they start using nuclear weapons, there's a treaty, everything calms down, people go off to the habitable parts of the globe in groups of allies, and along the way what's happened is that all the radiation has caused various kinds of mutations, new diseases sprout, there are plagues, and almost everybody gets wiped out. Not impossible. We can't put a probability on it. I hope there's not a high probability of something like that happening. But if we don't do anything about climate change, so the scientists tell us, that's the sort of thing that we might be faced with in the future. Now, you might say, well, you shouldn't really believe any of this stuff. It's all a bunch of hooey. But you've got to discuss it. If that's the kind of consequence that's possible, you can't just sort of sit still and postpone the issue. So we start with that, and we end the book with another much more modest and banal scenario about what might happen in the future. It's just a world in which all the things that we rely on seem to be breaking down constantly. There are constant weather events, constant heat waves, constant storms. Cell phone service isn't reliable. Medicines get sort of hoarded and are no longer generally available. Food is a bit spotty. The water's brown and a bit dirty. It's all rather nasty, not life-threatening, but the two protagonists in our dialogue, who by that stage are in their 80s, find it pretty uncomfortable and pretty worrying when they can't get in touch with their children and grandchildren who are in regions affected by storms and floods. So the last one is just, you know, the opposite pole from the truly apocalyptic, the just, you know, ordinarily awful future.
All right, the annoying future. So this obviously comes back to our time and choices we make now. And there's an interesting observation you make about how the political system functions around the passion and the intensity that we all bring to the discussion of climate change. What does that do to our dealing with it in politics?
Well, I think people just dig in their heels, and there's a tendency to, thump the table and to shout at one another. And I think if we're going to get anywhere, we have to get beyond that. I don't think in the contemporary polarized climate we're likely to get that from our politicians. But, you know, I've been encouraged by the thought that on a small and local scale, people can actually talk to one another. They can talk to their neighbors even when their neighbors are of different political persuasions. And they can try to figure things out together. And that's what we want to try to encourage. Around the family dinner table, in the workplace cafeteria, in a church or a synagogue or a mosque, at a PTA meeting. People who know one another and who know that they disagree, sit down together, try to work it out together. So at the end of our book, we supply a whole list of sources you can go to.
All right, that's the scenario of The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts by Philip Kitcher and Evelyn Fox Keller. Back with Philip Kitcher on The Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Philip Kitcher, professor of philosophy at Columbia University. He's been focused on the philosophy of science for a very long time, has just entered a phased retirement at Columbia. He and Evelyn Fox Keller, who teaches very similar material, and she's a professor emerita at MIT, wrote a book together called The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts. It is about climate change, far less about the science than about how to talk about the science, how to have discussions with other people. Six imagined dialogues in the book between Joe with an E and Joe without an E, male and female of various ages. We'll get into them in just a moment. You can join the conversation. You can be the average Joe, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So lay out the characters this really is average Joe and average Josephine, isn't it?
It's supposed to be. I think they're probably not average enough, but we tried. They come in different ages, different nationalities, in different dialogues. She is always in favor of climate action. He is always a bit skeptical about that. But I want to emphasize something. We tried to construct both our characters to be sympathetic, to be likable, and to put them in relation to one another. So they tend to like one another. In some cases, they are very much in love with one another. The thought is that by showing people in a relationship or being respectful to one another at the very least, disagreeing and working through things, we can give some options for how to carry out conversations about this really vexed issue.
There is a big footnote here before you get started with the dialogues about when this book was written. Would you explain what the caution was there?
Yeah, so we actually wrote the book pretty much as it stands after the Paris Agreement of 2015 had been signed, and the U.S., of course, had played a major role under President Obama in bringing that agreement about. And then, of course, as the book was in press, the Trump administration started to think about withdrawing from that agreement, and that changed everything. Any hope that people had that this was really the first step of an international collaboration to do something about this started to look very dubious indeed. And I have to say, I mean, like many other people who have been interested in this issue, we thought that the targets agreed on in Paris were too low, that not enough had been agreed to. But it was very promising. It was a start. It was the beginning of international cooperation. And then, apparently without consulting any climate scientists whatsoever, our current president decided that he would announce that we're pulling out. Of course, we haven't pulled out yet. That will take some time, and there's still a chance that he will reverse himself on this. And I hope very much that he will. But, you know, if that happens, it will be a huge blow to international cooperation.
So the speaking of the Paris Accords takes us right into the first dialogue, which deals in part with those, which raises just a general question. How hard is it just to get people on opposite sides of this, or I guess any issue, to agree just on the basic facts?
I think it's become unnecessarily difficult. It's now well documented that the fossil fuel companies have invested a lot of money in creating a cloud of confusion around this issue. President Obama was a little bit conservative when he said that 97% of the world's climate scientists agree that the average temperature of our planet is getting warmer and we're causing it. Now, in the first dialogue, our female character lays out for her husband the evidence for that. She points out the correlation between the high levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the higher temperature of our planet on average. And she points out that there's a well-known mechanism for how this works. It's been known since the end of the 19th century, and a Swedish chemist actually won a Nobel Prize for figuring it out. This is not junk science by any means. And then he says, rightly, well, I know that's a way it could have happened, but maybe there's something else that's going on. And she says, yeah, and the climate science community has considered that, and they've talked about things like whether this varies with the Earth's orbit and stuff like that, whether this is one of those ordinary, everyday garden variety perturbations that happens from time to time. And they've ruled out the other possibilities. And he says, well, how do you know that they've been thorough about that? And how do you know that they've constructed the records in the right way? There's a lot of statistics involved. You and I don't really understand how they've done all this. And she says, fair point. But, you know, how do you bring this kind of conspiracy off within a scientific community? It's really very hard. All the incentives for young scientists are to try to show that the accepted wisdom is wrong. And there's nobody who runs the world science who's like a mafia boss who can somehow enforce that everybody toes the line. On the other hand, we do know that the people, not climate scientists, but people from other areas of science, meteorology being the closest, physics, various bits of physics and chemistry, and lots of weather pundits around the country, have been hired by fossil fuel companies to give a very different and contradictory message. So that's what we know. If there's a conspiracy here, it's pretty clear which side it's on. And he says, well, yeah, okay, that's pretty persuasive. I'll think about it. And that's probably all you can expect from an initial dialogue. I mean, in a certain sense, his opposition is, we think, quite reasonable. When people start to think about this issue, they realize that if the science is as the climate science community says it is, there are consequences. People have to do things that they don't want to do. So the evidence needs to be pretty good. She tries to convince him that the evidence really is pretty good, that the fact that we are causing our planet to get seriously hotter is about as uncontroversial as the fact that our planet is round or that water is H2O.
Well, and that gets into a major issue for all of us, the idea of things that we can't prove ourselves. We're just not in a position to do that.
Right.
We talked to Stephen Sloman and Philip Fernbach a few months ago about the knowledge illusion. about why we never think alone, which is all about things like accepting when people in positions of expertise tell you this, that it's true. Have we gotten to a bit of a breakdown in that alone?
I think we have. I mean, if you remember, back in the British Brexit referendum, one of the supporters of leaving the European Union, Michael Gove in the Conservative Party, said, it's a breathtaking line, we've had enough of experts in this country. What he was talking about in particular were economic experts, but he didn't qualify it. We've had enough of experts. And if you start thinking, well, I shouldn't trust anybody who counts as an expert, you're going to be in deep trouble. I mean, in modern life, we are really compelled to pool information and to draw on the best sources we can. And to start distrusting a community that is, you know, that has worked very, very, very hard indeed to try to establish the facts about something is a really silly thing to do. We're social beings. We have to pool information in a complex world and in complex societies to get along. And turning our back on expertise is a very bad idea.
But on the other hand, now, Female Joe is challenged in the first dialogue for her, yep, her view of scientists as a secular priesthood, as people, yep, who are infallible. What is the counter to that?
Well, as she says, no, these are people. These are people with ordinary motivations. So let's suppose that these scientists have ordinary motivations. If you were a young scientist and you had, you know, you were completely unscrupulous, all you wanted was to make a name for yourself and to have lots of money to do your research, what would you do? If you were a young climate scientist, what you would, and you were like that, what you would do is jump on the bandwagon of the fossil fuel companies, grab the money, try to dislodge the orthodoxy. There aren't police around who can discipline you into doing that. Young scientists have plenty of incentives to break with the so-called orthodoxy. So, you know, it's really weird if you think that these people are just grubby, motivated by greed and the search for reputation and all that sort of thing, that the climate science community is so united. They're united because they've debated this extensively. People have questioned the various things that have been put forward in what is now the orthodoxy, and they've gone out, they've looked again. They've been admirably patient, and they've come to consensus on this. So, you know, what more do you want?
Which raises another question I'll get to in a second. I want to remind our listeners we're talking to Dr. Philip Kitcher, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, generally focusing on the philosophy of science. Evelyn Fox Keller has a similar focus in her work. She's professor emerita at MIT. They are the co-authors of The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts. The six acts are six imagined dialogues between a male Joe and a female Joe about the very issues that get debated in our world today, with an eye to how to have these discussions in a civil sense. You can join the conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange with your thoughts at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Philip, let me come back to you with there's a great section here about the what are you waiting for? Because I love this exploration you do of climate agnostics. Yeah. What are they waiting for?
Well, presumably they're waiting for the great event that will really show this. You know, show me something truly disastrous happening. Now, if the climate scientists are right, by the time something truly disastrous happens, we're locked into a series of big catastrophes that will get worse for at least a long while after the first one hits. So, as you might say, this is a bit like waiting for the miner's canary miners used to take canaries down mines, and if the canary started to droop, then they knew they had to get out of it. Well, in this case, by the time the canary starts to droop, you know, you're doomed. So agnosticism is not a viable position here. This has got to be, this agnosticism is equivalent in this regard to atheism, you know.
All right, so this moves us into a discussion of politics and democracy and free and open debate, which we appear to be having, but the debate is not informing us, you think?
Well, I think when the great apostles of free discussion in democratic societies, people like John Milton and Thomas Jefferson and John Stuart Mill, said, all right, what we need is a public forum in which people discuss freely and openly. When they had that in mind, they didn't, first of all, focus primarily on technical questions, questions that people didn't have a basis for deciding on for themselves. They were questions about things like divorce and, you know, what the press should be able to do and what kinds of things should be allowed in, whether education should be allowed to women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They weren't technical scientific questions. And they didn't bargain on the role that money can play in buying time at the public megaphone. I mean, if you've got people who have massive amounts of money and they're allowed to invest it in putting their spokesman in front of the microphone, then they can dominate the conversation far beyond the evidential basis of what they say. And if they are criticized for saying things that are false, they just say, no, it's not false, and keep saying the same thing again and again and again. And as we're learning, it works. So, unfortunately, we're in real trouble. We're in real trouble actually across the political spectrum, I think, with respect to issues of free speech and free debate. We sadly need a way of getting back, perhaps to the moments in American disputes in public life. I remember the Vietnam War, and I remember CBS News and Walter Cronkite signing off and saying, and that's the way it is, and then he would say the date. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that whatever people's views about that war and whatever they thought about people on different sides of the issue, they believed that that was the way it was. We've lost that, and that's a really sad thing for our current democracy, and we have to struggle to regain it. That's why we think at the moment what's needed is for people, as it were, to leave the public forum and set up lots and lots and lots of different private conversations with one another to see if some sort of agreement can be forged on a grassroots level.
Well, much smaller discussions than rather than the big, noisy debates. Philip Kitcher is the author of The Season's Altar with Evelyn Fox Keller. Here's a call from Pete in Weed. Welcome to the Exchange.
Howdy.
Hi.
I was wondering if it's true, and I believe it is, that it was much warmer on average 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. And why is that? And has not the sun, output of the sun, increased of late? That's a question. Thank you.
All right. So was it warmer 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, and has the sun's output increased of late, is the set of questions there?
Actually, the short answer to that is no and no. it wasn't. There was a significantly warmer period about 5 million years ago. And if we don't do anything about climate change, that's where we're headed, to that sort of extremely warm world.
And that was no ice in the oceans, is that right?
That's right. There is actually a slight decline in the global mean temperature, slight decline over the last 1,000 years up to about 1900. It's at 1900 that the temperature really starts to take off. There's a famous curve that's drawn by climate scientists called the hockey stick, and that shows this sort of very gentle slope down from, say, 900 to 1900. That's the long handle. And then the blade goes shooting up after that. And, you know, we're on course to gain minimum of 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century.
Let me jump in right here then with the scientific stuff and where this gets confusing. We did talk to somebody recently who said there's very little chance that we can keep the increase in temperatures down below a certain percentage, and it's not on the top of my head. Within 2 weeks, somebody else came out and said, no, it looks like our temperatures are going up more slowly now.
The temperature, the as you know, the warmest years on record have been the last two or three. I mean, there each year is setting a new record at the moment. So the idea that there's been sort of some kind of lull is based on a real confusion. Now, I would say that if we act positively and very decisively right now, we might be able to prevent the temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius over the 1900 level by the end of the century. If we don't do anything at all bets are off. It could be as high as 7 or 8 degrees Celsius. That would take us into really warm territory. 5 degrees Celsius above the 1900 temperature is a time when there's no ice on the earth anywhere, where you've got crocodiles and alligators in the polar region.
All right. Much more to talk about with Philip Kitcher. His book is The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in 6 Acts, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Kitcher and you in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about climate change today, but not so much directly on the science as the philosophy of it all and how we can talk to each other about this and not get hung up on the numbers and the no, you're wrong, the way that we tend to talk about things. We're looking at a book by Philip Kitcher and Evelyn Fox Keller called The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in 6 Acts. It is 6 dialogues between a male Joe and a female Joe. They often love each other, but they just disagree on this basic set of issues, and they are discussing it quietly. They are listening to each other, which is a real guide for what the rest of us might consider doing. Philip Kitcher is a professor of philosophy, studying the science, philosophy of science, rather, in particular, in a phased retirement now at Columbia University. You can join our conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by email jx@jeffnet.org. So let's see, philosophy or math? Let me go to philosophy first. Plato. Because you get into the debates of society now. Plato had a problem with democracy, as you point out.
Indeed he did. He thought that that democracy would inevitably fail because ordinary people aren't really smart enough to figure out what's good for them. And we think Plato was wrong, that ordinary people are plenty smart enough to figure out what's good for them. But Plato's worry can be... can come true if they're badly enough misinformed. And as we've been talking, we tend to live in a world today where it's pretty easy to get misinformation out there. I mean, we've been reading about this just today with misinformation running wild on the internet about the man who was responsible for that dreadful shooting in Las Vegas. I mean, misinformation is all over the place, and people who believe the wrong things are going to make bad policy choices, and when that happens, democracy really starts to break down.
So, particularly on climate change, I mean, and in the second conversation, female Joe is laying out some scenarios about extreme weather and things like that, and obviously we've had some things to buttress her argument very recently with the storms that hit Houston and Florida and now Puerto Rico, three gigantic hurricanes that most people are saying, well, I can't recall seeing anything like this. I mean, we're talking three times the rain of the annual rainfall of Medford, Oregon fell on Houston in a week. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, since we don't get to live for 6,000 years, I mean, how can we be sure that this is that unusual?
Well, climate scientists are very conservative, actually. They tend to understate the warnings. And one thing they always tell people is don't look at individual events. So it may well be that, most people believe these days that if you smoke a lot of cigarettes, you may well end up with severe lung problems like cancer and emphysema. But if you take an individual cancer patient who smoked a lot, it's very difficult to say about that cancer patient that his or her disease problems were caused by the smoking. And similarly, with respect to these hurricanes, it's the fact that there are three of them, it's a small pattern. Perhaps some climate scientists would say, yeah, there's some evidence here. What's really diagnostic in this case is the fact that extreme weather events, really extreme weather events, and that means wildfires, heat waves, floods, droughts, storms, have been increasing in frequency with the rise in concentration of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So there is a very, very strong argument, very strong evidence for saying that what we're doing is really increasing the frequency of things like hurricanes and wildfires and huge heat waves and big droughts and big floods. That you can say. So you can say probabilistically, if you smoke, that's likely to increase your chances by quite a lot of getting heart disease, lung cancer, emphysema, and so forth. We can say the same sort of thing about climate change. Look at the pattern. Look at the big pattern. You don't have to live 6,000 years to see that. We can begin to see it over the last decades in what's starting to happen.
Let us take a call here. We have Glenn in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Philip Kitcher, the co-author of The Seasons Alter.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Three points to make. The one is about the statement about the warmest period in Earth history. That's not 5 million years ago. That was 55 to 50 million years ago in the Eocene. That's the hottest.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I dropped to zero. Thank you for very much for that correction.
And the Earth's been gradually cooling since then. We started to get ice around the poles 30 to 20 million years ago. The ice age officially has started, the most recent one, about 2 million years ago. We have these interglacials where it gets warmer, cooler within the ice age, and the warming happens fast and the cooling happens slowly. So that's the actual record. And the other point I wanted to make was about oil companies, and you might be surprised to know that Rex Tillerson, who was the head of Exxon way back in 2009, said the carbon tax would be a good idea. And the oil companies, Shell, Chevron, BP, they all came out just the last year and said that, yeah, carbon tax is a good idea. Now, it would be fair to say they're not exactly pushing really hard for it, but they are on record as saying that if you're going to deal with this, the carbon tax is the way to go. And the third point I'd like to make is that you may be doubtful about the certainty with which the results are presented about climate change, but I really found the way to be effective in talking to people is to say, we only have one atmosphere, and we're conducting this giant experiment with it. It's the only atmosphere we have, and it's not a good idea to do this experiment. And I'd like to take your comments.
Thank you. Very much, Glenn. Let me start with the third thing you said. You're not only right about that, it's actually something we say in the book. We're thinking about geoengineering, and we distinguish between what we call negative geoengineering and positive geoengineering. So negative geoengineering tries to prevent more carbon from getting into the atmosphere or tries to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. And that's basically trying to take us back to a situation we've been in before. Positive geoengineering is the one where you try to inject something else into the atmosphere. The favorite one, of course, being to inject sulfur particles into the atmosphere. That's doing an experiment with the one atmosphere we have. And as you rightly point out, that's a really risky proposition, especially given the history of our experiments on various ecosystems where we've tried well-intentioned programs for eradicating diseases that have had all sorts of unintended and unforeseen bad side effects. So that's a terrific point, and it's one that one of our female protagonists makes. Now, your point about the cooling trends is you're completely correct about that, at least as far as my memory is serving me at the moment. I felt that the previous questioner was asking a question really about the last few thousand years. And, of course, the hockey stick graph tends to get drawn over about a period of about 1,000 years, and it shows this nice, rather gentle downward slope, the world getting a bit cooler, and then the sun. sudden upsurge once you get the input from the Industrial Revolution. What you did was put that in the context of much wider trends. And that, and your first point, thank you very much for correcting me on that. It is indeed the 50 million years ago in the Eocene that you see the really the big high point, and that's the period with the basically 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures, and that's the period with no ice on the Earth and the crocodilians were close to the poles.
So, right, and what Pete in Weed was referring to, he prodded us via email or called back anyway, but he was talking about the mid-Holocene warming period about 6,000 years ago, which was apparently caused by differences in Earth orbit and how solar radiation applied to certain bands of the Earth, which NOAA has examined and says that's not what's happening now.
Right. So it's very interesting to look at the, if you can find them on the internet, there are very good and reliable graphs where you've got superimposed on one another. We reproduce one of these in the book. The concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, typically CO2 in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, with the temperature. So you've got sort of two graphs that run along together on the same axes. And essentially, there's a sort of oscillation around the they sort of are like intertwining snakes, if you want to think about it that way. And the little deviations get caused by things like changes in the Earth's orbit or sunspot activity or volcanic activity, things like that. The big driver of all of this is actually the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Now, one of the ways in which the book, I would say, breaks some new ground in The Seasons Alter is that you get us to think about the fact, I mean, it's really kind of an oh yeah moment for me, like, oh yeah, that even if we completely agree on what has happened up until now and what will continue to happen, we can still disagree on what should be done. And so this is where the latter dialogues really get into some interesting zones.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the first question is, which is the one that we've spent most time on and which, in fact, the American public has spent most time on, is this really happening? Let's assume that we agree that it is happening. Then there's a question of, well, how much does it matter? And that's the subject of our second dialogue. And then the third dialogue is about whether we should take the problems of the future more seriously than the problems of the present. Now, let's suppose we've got all of those straight now, and we've decided that it really does matter and that we really owe something to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to give them a habitable world, then we have to decide what to do. And there'll be some people who will say, well, what we should actually do at this point is invest lots of money in scientific research to solve the problem scientifically, find a way of sucking the greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. That would be wonderful if it occurred. But the protagonist of the female protagonist of our fourth dialogue says, I'm not going to bet my children's and grandchildren's future on that alone. We've got to have some alternative to that. So what else do we do? Well, there you can go with Rex Tillerson and the energy companies' rather pious, I think, declaration that we need a carbon tax. The carbon tax is a good idea. It's a good idea to try to get the market to reduce the investment in fossil fuels energy and increase the investment in renewable resources. Now, if that happened, that would be very good, and it would help to prevent a really extreme condition in the future. That probably isn't going to be enough. So now you've got to decide on a combination of policies to try to get the world, not just the United States, not just the United States and China, but the whole world to make a transition to basically a zero fossil fuel economy. How is that going to be done? It's very, very hard to outline in advance a way of doing that.
Not only that, but even if 7 billion people change their behavior today, how soon might the change be reflected in the Earth around us?
Well, if t- if people changed their behavior drastically and immediately, that would probably have colossal consequences for their lives. If we all said, you know, we're never going to use fossil fuel energy again as of, let's say, January the 1st, 2018, as many people of all political stripes would say, that would be catastrophic. The world economy would collapse. Everything would break down. Probably people would freeze and starve, and all sorts of other awful things would go wrong. We couldn't run our hospitals. We couldn't manufacture medicines that people need. It would be utterly disastrous. So you've got somehow to do this quickly as possible, without disrupting people's lives. And the only way we can see of doing that is to try out a lot of experiments and protect societies and people while those experiments are being run. So to use an analogy that we very much like, it's as if we're lost in a dark wood and have to find our way out. We have to try various paths and see if we can find some way or another. And the only clues we have is a little bit of light through some of the trees.
Indeed. The book is called The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts. It's a real non-screaming guide to how we potentially could have conversations about climate change as we move into the future. Philip Kitcher at Columbia University, Evelyn Fox Keller at MIT, the co-authors. Philip Kitcher has been our guest. And thank you for that, Philip.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation. And thank you to the two callers for their comments.
All right, sure. Take care.